way to solve problems, including addressing this healthcare crisis.
How are Democrats navigating the government shutdown?
We will hear from the party's House leader.
For Thursday, October 2nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsie Chang. Ahead, Pope Leo has caused a recruiting boom for the religious order that he spent his adult life in.
It was quite typical that we would get two or three discerners, but I now have 15 discerners. It's unbelievable.
And generating realistic crowds has long been a challenge for AI software.
But it's getting easier and easier to fabricate a crowd of digital people, and that ripples out to everything from entertainment to news and politics.
We're moving into a world where the lines of reality are going to get really blurry.
Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump and congressional leaders aren't expected to meet anytime soon to discuss ending the government shutdown. House Speaker Mike Johnson is calling on Democrats to support a Republican bill to reopen the government at current spending levels. But Democrats are holding out. They're calling for an extension of tax credits for health plans offered under the Affordable Care Act. Johnson says Democrats are asking for a wild list of partisan priorities.
It is selfish. It is reprehensible. And it is exactly the opposite of what they have all said themselves in their own words very passionately every day until now.
Republican leaders say the Obamacare tax credits can wait since the subsidies expire at the end of the year. Russian President Vladimir Putin says it is Europe's responsibility to end the war in Ukraine. Putin's comments come at a political forum where he also touched on recent remarks by President Trump. NPR's Charles Maines has details from Moscow.
In his remarks, Putin blamed Europe for dragging out the war in Ukraine through its military support for Kyiv and vowed to respond to Europe's militarization amid what he argued were falsely hyped Russian threats. Yet Putin said reports that the U.S. was considering providing American-made Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine would mark a new stage of escalation. Putin also took aim at President Trump's recent comments calling Russia a paper tiger over its failure to subdue its neighbor. In response, Putin said Russia had been fighting the entirety of the NATO alliance and was still making steady advancements in Ukraine. If we are a paper tiger, asked Putin, then what is NATO itself? Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Many people are still having a hard time getting vaccinated against COVID-19 because of an unusual delay by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. NPR's Rob Stein has the story.
The CDC has yet to issue final guidelines for the COVID vaccines nearly 2 weeks after receiving the recommendations from the agency's advisors. That's highly unusual. Typically, the CDC acts within days, sometimes even hours of receiving recommendations from the advisory committee because of the urgency of getting people vaccinated for the winter surge. The delay has prevented a federal program from shipping out free vaccines for kids and has meant that a patchwork of state rules has prevented adults from getting shots in many places too. Federal officials have not explained the delay. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Federal officials have approved another generic version of the abortion pill, mifepristone, triggering outrage from anti-abortion advocates. Drug maker Evita Solutions announced that the FDA signed off on its form of the pill. Students for Life Action called the approval, quote, a stain on the Trump presidency and another sign that the deep state at the FDA must go. Mifepristone was approved 25 years ago and has been repeatedly deemed safe. From Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News. FIFA is facing growing global calls to suspend Israeli soccer teams over the country's war in Gaza, but the organization's chief says it must promote peace and unity. Gianni Infantino says the governing organization for soccer can't solve global political issues. Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run turned 50 this year. Recently, The Boss and the E Street Band sat down on stage for the first time to explain how they created the landmark album. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from the Bruce Springsteen archives at Monmouth University.
Springsteen's first two albums had not sold. He needed a hit.
It was all or nothing, because in the rest of my life at that time, I had nothing.
Springsteen is a notorious perfectionist. He drove the band as well as studio engineer Jimmy Iovine.
I never met a person before or after that I could say the same word over and over and over and over and over. Two words, no and again.
It worked.
Whoa, 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 thunder, take her.
album peaked at number 3 on the Billboard chart and launched Springsteen to stardom. Frank Langford, NPR News, West Long Branch, New Jersey.
A comet from another star system will swing by Mars tomorrow. The comet known as 3I Atlas will hurtle within 18 million miles of the red planet, its closest approach during its trek through the inner solar system. The European Space Agency and NASA are already observing the comet, which is only the third interstellar object known to have passed our way. From Washington, this is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. It is day two of the federal government shutdown, and so far there is no clear end in sight. Democrats and Republicans remain at an impasse. President Trump is leaning into blaming Democrats with threats to permanently cut thousands of federal jobs and a promise to cut what he called, quote, Democrat agencies in government. Democrats say that Republicans could have avoided this as they control the White House and both houses in Congress. They continue to insist on Republican concessions on health care, including extending tax credits for Affordable Care Act insurance plans. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries joins me now. He is a Democrat from New York. Leader Jeffries, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
I want to start with this. Earlier today, President Trump called the shutdown, quote, an unprecedented opportunity to achieve his agenda. He has frozen tens of billions of dollars in funds for Democratic-run states, including New York. He's eyeing major cuts to federal agencies. I want to play a moment from Vice President Vance speaking yesterday at the White House.
We are going to have to lay some people off if the shutdown continues. We don't like that. We don't necessarily want to do it, but we're going to do what we have to keep the American people's essential services continuing to run.
I want to start with this. Has this shutdown handed more power to the Trump administration?
No, the Trump administration has been out of control since day one. They've been laying people off since day one. They've been firing federal employees since day one, and they've been violating the law since day one. It's unfortunate that we now find ourselves in this Trump-Republican shutdown because they don't want to provide health care to working-class Americans. Democrats are ready to sit down, have a conversation, find a bipartisan solution, moving forward, reopen the government, but we have to protect the health care of the American people.
But wasn't that a big reason why you and other leaders did not move forward with possibly causing a shutdown in March? I mean, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said it plainly. He was worried a government shutdown then would give the administration permission to wreak havoc on agencies. What was the change in thinking?
Well, House Democrats, myself included, strongly opposed the partisan continuing resolution in March because of the fact that it did substantive damage to everyday Americans. It hurt seniors, it hurt veterans, it hurt children, it hurt families, it hurt affordable care, and it hurt housing programs that people desperately need in this high cost of living environment. That's why we opposed it in March. And this bill is just a continuation of that on top of the Republican healthcare crisis.
I guess my question is, if these mass layoffs go forward, what would you tell a federal employee who says, you know, I lost my job and I feel like it's because Democrats forced this shutdown?
What's clear is that the American people know who shut the government down, and it's Donald Trump and Republicans. That's clear to the American people because Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and Republicans, the Trump administration, have been engaging in mass firings since the beginning of Donald Trump's presidency. And that's outside of the context of a government shutdown. This would just be a pretense that Republicans would use to do what they were otherwise going to do anyway.
It's happening regardless in your mind.
I want to ask you about another Democrat's point of view. Yesterday, I interviewed Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada. She's one of three Democrats who broke ranks with the party and voted in favor of the Republican funding bill. I asked her why. Here's what she said.
I think it's important for us to really work in a bipartisan way to solve problems, including addressing this looming health care crisis that we have. I see it in Nevada when I'm home. And we should be working together to solve those problems. We don't need to shut down the government to do that.
What's your response to that? I know there's some differences of opinion within a Democratic caucus here on the path forward.
The overwhelming majority of Democrats are standing firm because we recognize that the healthcare crisis is not looming, it is upon us. Republicans have already enacted the largest cut to Medicaid in American history. That was part of their one big ugly bill. Hospitals and nursing homes and community-based health clinics are closing because of Republican malignant action all across America. They are setting in motion a possible $536 billion cut to Medicare at the end of this year because of what they did in the one big ugly bill. And we know that as a result of their refusal to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits, more than 20 million working class Americans are going to experience dramatically increased premiums, co-pays, and deductibles, whereas in the Trump economy, the cost of living is already too high.
How much?
That's why there's urgency to this fight right now.
How much would these subsidies fix those broader problems, though? And they already exist, and people are already having a hard time paying for health care.
We're talking about 20 million Americans whose premiums, co-pays, and deductibles are about to skyrocket. And beyond that, you certainly are correct. There's a Republican healthcare crisis. We have to fix our broken healthcare system. We have to lower the high cost of living. These are things that need to happen. And the moment is now to begin to work on these matters urgently. That's what we said in that White House meeting to Donald Trump, to Mike Johnson, and to John Thune. This is a matter that requires urgent attention. Johnson claimed that healthcare is extraneous. Healthcare is not extraneous. It's central to the well-being of everyday Americans.
There's some action on the other side of the Capitol from you. There's a small bipartisan group of Senate lawmakers who are trying to come up with some sort of compromise about having that conversation about health care, but giving the government up and running again. Is that action that you take seriously? Are those talks that you're closely watching?
Well, dialogue is important in terms of what's happening over on the Senate side. I defer to Leader Schumer as it relates to those conversations. We need to cancel the cuts, lower the costs, and save health care.
I want to ask you about the messaging battle, which, as you know, is really important to a shutdown. It usually decides how it ends. A lot of our reporters across the country are hearing that aspects of Republican messaging are getting through, including this false claim that undocumented immigrants would get health care coverage. That's something we are hearing a lot in our interviews. It's showing up in polling. Are you worried Democrats are losing that messaging battle?
Of course we're not losing that messaging battle. And the reason why we know we're not, one, they're lying, and they're lying because they're losing. There's nothing that Democrats have suggested in any way, shape, or form that is designed to provide health care to undocumented immigrants. The law prohibits taxpayer dollars from being spent in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act. And we know the American people aren't buying it because the overwhelming majority of the American people know that it was Donald Trump and Republicans who shut down the government, and they're being blamed for that malignant action.
Here's what your plan is through the weekend for the coming days. Are you having direct conversations with the White House? What comes next?
Since the White House meeting that took place on Friday, it's been radio silent. We haven't heard a word from them because they wanted to shut down the government, but now they're going to bear the consequences of doing that. I'm here in the Capitol. We're ready. We're willing. We're able to sit down with anyone, anytime, any place here at the Capitol or back at the White House to fund the government, reopen the government, make sure that we pass a spending agreement that meets the needs of the American people, while at the same time decisively address the Republican health care crisis.
We got about 30 seconds left. The last shutdown lasted 35 days. Can your caucus hold together for 35 plus days? Is this a long haul situation in your mind?
We need to get this matter resolved sooner rather than later. That's why I'm here in Washington, and we'll continue to be here to meet with anyone at any time and at any place to get this issue resolved.
That is House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you much.
There is a new number one album, and thanks to a strange quirk, it was certified platinum instantly upon its release. NPR's Stephen Thompson has this report.
Taylor Swift's new album won't hit the Billboard charts until the week after next. But in the meantime, a different major star debuts atop the album's chart. The rapper Cardi B with her new record, Am I the Drama? Am I the Drama is Cardi B's first album since her debut, Invasion of Privacy, hit number one 7 years ago. And in the interim, she's released several gigantic hit singles, including WAP featuring Megan Thee Stallion and Up. WAP came out in 2020, Up followed a year later. Both hit number one on the Billboard singles chart. But they had never appeared on a Cardi B album until now. Combined, those two songs have accumulated more than 2 billion streams on Spotify alone. Now that they appear on Am I the Drama, the album gets retroactive credit for all that streaming, which means it was certified platinum on the day of its release. Less than 2 weeks later, Am I the Drama is now double platinum, not to mention the week's top seller and the top album on streaming. 16 of its songs land on this week's Hot 100, led by Safe featuring Kehlani at number 26. Cardi B went out of her way to make Am I the Drama a blockbuster. She has been aggressive about making promotional appearances, both in person and on television. And the album is available for sale in many different formats, with lots of variant editions containing bonus tracks to boost sales. The result? When it comes to converting her albums into multi-platinum chart toppers, Cardi B is already 2 for 2. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at 4 shows this Friday and Saturday, October 3rd and 4th, in Baxter, Duluth, and Bemidji. First up, Eli Gardner is playing Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter this Friday at 6 p.m., an Americana, gravelly-voiced singer-songwriter who blends folk, rock, and blues with stories of working class and everyday folks. His last album arrived in 2023, but he's released a handful of singles so far this year. Eli Gardner, this Friday, at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. On to Saturday for a pair of events in Duluth. First, Delilith Fest runs from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Chester Bowl Park. Inspired by the Lilith Fair Festival of the 90s, the Lilith Fest features an all-women or non-male identifying lineup, including acclaimed folk singer Galen Lee, rising Americana duo The Penny Peaches, Jerry Small, and many more. 11 to 7 this Saturday in Duluth. Then, Canadian country and western singer Coulter Wall is also playing at 7:30 at the Deck Symphony Hall. Known for his deep voice and Townes Van Zandt-inspired songwriting, Wall has been a leading figure in country music since the mid-teens and recently announced his latest album, Memories and Empties, due out in November. It's Coulter Wall this Saturday at the Deck in Duluth. Finally, there is a punk and metal show late Saturday evening at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. 4 bands are on the lineup, including Bemidji groups Rotten Sardines playing punk and metal from Noxious Gould. Music begins at 9 p.m. at the Folk School, and the event is hosted by Sundown Records. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Comes from this station and from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Pope Leo XIV is not only the first North American pontiff, he is also the first Augustinian friar to head the Roman Catholic Church. And since his election earlier this year, Catholic men are showing an increased interest in joining Leo's religious order. The Augustinians are a small group. There are fewer than 3,000 friars in the entire world, so the uptick is noticeable. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports on the Augustinians, their communities, and their ideal of holy friendship.
Will you come and follow me if I but call your name?
This summer, U.S. Augustinians welcomed three men into the order during a mass in Chicago. Among them, James Schlegel took his vows before friends and family and fellow friars.
I, James Michael Schlegel, led by the Holy Spirit, declare my intention to follow Jesus Christ more closely.
Schlegel knelt before the altar and promised poverty, chastity, obedience, and to follow the rule of 4th century church father Augustine.
And our Holy Father Augustine, I give myself to God and unite myself to his will.
This day was the culmination of years of discernment for Schlegel, who's now 32. In his early and mid-20s, his life was different.
Anything that a young man would do, I was doing. My heart was hurting. It was open, and I wanted direction.
He eventually discerned a call to the priesthood and to the Augustinian order. He thought deeply about the vows he'd promised to follow for the rest of his life.
Poverty, chastity, obedience. These are ways that we can open ourselves up to Christ and open ourselves up to the people he asks us to serve.
But that discernment wasn't done in isolation. Schlegel met regularly with others exploring their calling.
We prayed the Liturgy of the Hours. We spoke about where we felt like we were being led. Father Phil also posed books from St. Augustine to us to read.
Father Phil is the vocations director for Augustinians in the Western U.S., Philip Yang. His work with men considering a call to the priesthood has changed since Pope Leo's election in May.
It was quite typical that we would get two or three discerners, but with Pope Leo, after his election, I now have 15 discerners. It's unbelievable.
Aside from the new attention Leo brings to the order, Yang says the appeal is that unlike most priests who live alone, Augustinians live with other friars.
So there's what we call intentional community. After ministry's done, when the day is done, you come back home to share a meal with your brothers, to pray the Psalms together, and to have this holy time of friendship.
Friendship, says Yang, in service to more than staving off loneliness.
When Christ talked to the disciples, Christ says, "You are no longer slaves, you are my friends." And for St. Augustine, he took that very seriously. He really loved friendship. And for him, true holiness can come from deep friendship.
This is a theology of friendship.
We're not like holy roommates with one another.
Father Max Villeneuve is an Augustinian and the pastor of Our Mother of Good Counsel Parish in Los Angeles.
It's one mind and heart intent upon God is what St. Augustine says. Before all else, love God and one another. So it's about intentionally forming a community with purpose.
The purpose, growing closer to God. Villeneuve says this theme appears time and again in Augustine's writings.
I went and sought you out in all the things of the world, and you weren't there, and all I had to recognize was that you were here with me the entire time. And so the Augustinian path is really, Lord, let me know myself that I may know you.
Villeneuve takes me to a mosaic laid into an exterior wall of his church.
Different depictions of this mosaic I just think are really lovely and just show some of our Augustinian family and our Augustinian saints.
A cloud of witnesses who grew closer to God, says Villeneuve, through knowing friends and knowing themselves.
Augustine and St. Monica, Claire of Montefalco, St. Rita of Cascia, who's probably our most popular saint.
James, receive the rule and constitutions of the Order of St. Augustine.
Back at Jane Schlegel's vow ceremony, Father Tony Pizzo welcomes him into the order.
May the Lord grant you the grace to observe all of these precepts with love. As a lover of spiritual beauty, radiating by your good life the example of Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Schlegel says he is at peace in a way he had not imagined when he first became a novice.
The first 2 days in the novitiate, quite frankly, I was terrified. I was sleeping and my heart was pounding and I was scared. And I asked the Blessed Virgin Mary, help me stay here. And she did.
And staying, says Schlegel, changed him.
Community is like a tray full of precious gems, each one beautiful, but they're jagged. And what community does is it shakes that tray, which then leads to the other gems grinding each other until it becomes smooth.
Still distinct, but polished by each other through life together. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Spooky season has officially started, so we're taking a look at a tricky word that has haunted the headlines in recent years, thanks in large part to President Trump. The word is hoax. That's no joke. As part of our Word of the Week series, NPR's Scott Newman reports.
In the last decade, President Trump has labeled a lot of things as hoaxes.
We had to put up with the Russia hoax.
The carbon footprint is a hoax.
It's really a Democrat hoax. It's a hoax that's been built up way beyond proportion.
The word hoax has a long history. Dave Wilton is the editor of wordorigins.org. He says it can be traced back to stage magic.
The noun is pretty well established by 1800. And where it seems to come from is from an older use of the word hocus, as in hocus pocus.
Jim Steinmeier is an author, magic consultant, and executive editor at Genie Magazine. He says the phrase hocus pocus appeared around the 1620s and seems to have been first conjured by a popular street performer named William Vincent.
And he used the stage name hocus pocus and also very prominently used it as his magic words.
Steinmeier says Vincent took every opportunity to self-promote using those words.
So I think what you see is that's a kind of 17th century branding. You know, he repeats his name for the audience and he makes his name be part of the formula that accomplishes the magic.
Steinmeier says that marketing gave the phrase staying power and that hocus pocus continued as a staple of magic acts.
Hocus pocus became a shorthand for the world of magic. He was forgotten, but later generations of magicians used the word hocus pocus and audiences knew what that meant.
Over time, that magical incantation became a common word for deceit, and then to describe a broader deception, like what happened in the 1820s when Scottish con artist Gregor MacGregor concocted a fake country in Central America named Poyais. Asia Radin is the author of the book, The Truth About Lies, A Taxonomy of Deceit, Hoaxes, and Cons. She says MacGregor sold the idea to investors and would-be settlers, who soon set sail for the fictional country.
But before they left, of course, he said, Poyais has its own currency, so exchange me all your money.
Radin says the hoax became apparent when the European settlers arrived and they found only uninhabited jungle. It's a classic case, she says, of a big lie being more believable than a small one. Scott Newman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at MoveItRealEstate.com. Now for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report.
10 new cases of measles have been confirmed in Minnesota since Monday, all in the Twin Cities metro area. The Minnesota Department of Health announced its findings Wednesday, noting that the new cases can all be tied to domestic or international travel and are among unvaccinated people. This brings the total number of cases confirmed in the state this year to 18. Health officials are urging families to make sure they are up to date on their immunizations, especially ahead of travel. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has confirmed more than 1,500 measles cases in the U.S. this year, the highest number since 1992. There have also been three confirmed deaths. The health department emphasizes that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is very effective, and decades of data also show that it is safe. Minnesota's state budget director says most state programs that rely on federal funding have enough money to mitigate the impact of a federal shutdown in the short term. The Minnesota Reformer reported on a news conference on Thursday addressing the shutdown. But Anna Mingi says that a prolonged shutdown lasting several weeks would have serious consequences for programs like SNAP and WIC, which use mostly federal dollars to provide food assistance to families in need. The federal shutdown began Wednesday, and there's no end in sight. Federal employees are facing furloughs, job reassignments, work without pay, and the threat of being fired. Mingi says food benefits look to be funded through the month of October, but money could run out if the shutdown extends into November. The federal government is expected to continue sending Social Security checks and making Medicaid and Medicare payments during the shutdown. The director of the Federal Office of Management and Budget, Russ Vogt, says the Trump administration is canceling funding for more than 220 Green New Deal projects in blue states, including in Minnesota. When diving into prison population data, men are often the focus. But researchers are gathering information on troubling statistics for women, with Minnesota cited in a new report. The Prison Policy Initiative says around the world, the number of imprisoned women has grown by almost 60% since 2000, with the U.S. factoring heavily in that number. Minnesota is below the national rate and most other states, but it still outpaces most of America's closest international allies. The Policy Initiative's Wanda Bertram says men are still incarcerated at higher rates, but recent declines show promise. She says it's a different situation for women right now.
The criminalization of essentially addiction, of mental illness, and of poverty has driven women's incarceration in a way that is distinct from what has happened for men.
She's referring to prosecutions of low-level offenses such as petty theft. Minnesota's incarceration rate for women is 53 inmates per 100,000 people. In 2021, the state adopted a law that places pregnant and postpartum inmates into alternative housing with their newborns for up to a year. Other research has noted forced separation is one of many harmful effects that prevent women from staying out of prison. Bertram says on the surface, overall incarceration numbers for women appear minor. But she says the recent trends suggest that elected officials can't overlook what's happening. A consistent lack of access to diversion programs is one roadblock, and she thinks states need to invest more in social safety nets.
You can invest in healthcare, you can invest in community services to keep people out of the criminal justice system.
The report also touches on racial disparities. For example, in Minnesota and neighboring states, Native American women are significantly overrepresented in prisons. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. An event at Minnesota North College Itasca will highlight banned books next week as part of Banned Books Week. The American Library Association and Amnesty International declared the week at, quote, a time when free speech and free expression seem more directly under fire than ever. The liberal arts faculty on the Itasca campus in Grand Rapids will host an open reading for faculty, students, and community members. Participants can share passages from books they cherish that have been banned, censored, or removed from libraries and school curriculums. The free event will take place at 7 p.m. Monday in the McMahon Student Center. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters tomorrow. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California. Israel's interception of a flotilla of hundreds of activists, lawyers, and politicians bringing aid to Gaza has been met with widespread international condemnation. There have been massive protests and diplomatic fallout in several countries. Meanwhile, Israel is pressing on with its ground operation against Hamas in Gaza, where it has ordered residents of the most populous city to leave, giving them one last chance, it says. Here to discuss all of this and more is NPR's Ruth Sherlock, who's in Rome. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
So let's start with this flotilla. I mean, we've seen camera footage of Israeli soldiers boarding the boats of activists and lawyers and politicians. What's the situation now?
Well, Israel's now intercepted most of those vessels, and it's likely going to deport those on board back to their home countries. So the activists haven't succeeded in that mission to break the naval blockade and deliver aid to Gaza. But, Elsa, this is a PR nightmare for Israel. You know, stopping the flotilla has sparked all these protests all around the world. Here in Rome, where I am, something like 10,000 people came to the streets kind of spontaneously last night in response. Yeah. And Italy's national unions have been calling for a big strike this week. And Israel's repeatedly said it considers the flotilla a Hamas-linked provocation with no permission to enter its waters. But many countries don't see it that way. Colombia has expelled all remaining Israeli diplomats over this. Turkey, Mexico, Ireland, Malaysia. These are just some of the countries that have condemned Israel's actions. And, you know, this flotilla journey, it lasted weeks and it was live-streamed by the activists. And it's become this kind of vehicle that people have gotten behind to express the anger they feel at the scale of the death toll and suffering in Gaza.
Yeah. And while this has been happening, an Israeli airstrike hit aid workers in Gaza, right? And now Israel, as we've mentioned, is saying that Palestinians have one last opportunity to leave Gaza City.
Yeah, so the charity Doctors Without Borders has told NPR that five of its staff were hit in an Israeli airstrike in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Four of those were badly wounded and a fifth, an occupational therapist, was killed. The charity is saying they were on their way to work at a burns and trauma field hospital. And as you say, you know, Israel's ground operation is now focused on taking Gaza City, the most populous city in Gaza. And the shelling has been so intense that aid groups have pulled out, you know, some of the last medical help has had to leave. About 400,000 Palestinians have fled the fighting. And Israel's defense minister has now said everyone there has to leave and that those who remain will be considered militants. But there are still hundreds of thousands of people there. Many are elderly, wounded, or sick, or don't have the resources to flee. And they fear that there's nowhere safe to go.
Well, while all of that has been happening, President Trump made a 20-point proposal for ending the war. Where does that proposal stand now?
Well, everyone's waiting for a response from Hamas. I mean, the proposal asks Hamas to set free its hostages and Israel to release hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. But to end the war, Hamas also has to give up power in Gaza and disarm. The proposal, it's been accepted by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but it's causing anger among far-right ministers in Israel, important to his governing coalition, who don't want Palestinians to be allowed to remain in Gaza at all. And as for Hamas, Qatar is trying to help mediate, and its prime minister told Al Jazeera that more discussion and negotiation is needed. But it's not at all clear that the Trump administration is open to any further negotiations. So we're going to have to see.
That is NPR's Ruth Sherlock in Rome. Thank you, Ruth.
Thanks so much.
As President Trump has talked about his decision to send the National Guard to Portland, Oregon, he has called the city war-ravaged and said troops are there to end the, quote, radical left's reign of terror. Lauren Dake from Oregon Public Broadcasting reports from the city where officials and residents say that is not the reality on the ground.
On Tuesday, Margaret Wilson watched her granddaughter play on the monkey bars at a local Portland, Oregon elementary school. The two were then going to do their normal after-school activities.
We do arts and crafts and cooking. We're baking biscuits. I've made chicken soup.
Wilson's husband and sons served in the military. She says the president's description of the city is not her experience.
Portland, Oregon, where it looks like a war zone. And I get a call from the liberal governor. Sir, please don't come in. We don't need you. I said, well, unless they're playing false tapes, this looked like World War II. Your place is burning down.
It's not clear what tapes the president has seen. NPR reached out to the White House for clarification. They responded by email and did not specify, but said that protesters outside an ICE facility in Portland had been charged with arson and assaulting police officers this summer. They described the activity as radical violence. The Portland Police Bureau characterizes the protests differently. Over the past couple of months, there have been some confrontational protests outside the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement building. But typically, says Portland's police chief Bob Day, they have largely been nonviolent and contained.
City of Portland is about 145 square miles. This is one city block. And even the events that are happening down there do not rise to the level of attention that they are receiving.
Some people, including Oregon's Governor Tina Kotek, have wondered whether the president has confused footage from the 2020 protests that rocked the city for months after the murder of George Floyd with what's happening now. During that time, it was a regular battle scene between hundreds of protesters and authorities who often used tear gas. Today, Portland does have real problems. There's an affordable housing crisis, and many people are unhoused. But its violent crime rate is down. And Governor Tina Kotek said on social media, military intervention isn't required.
Portland is not war ravaged. There's no insurrection. There's no threat to national security, and there's no need for military troops.
In the wake of the president's announcement that he was sending the National Guard, Portland resident Heather Gray's phone blew up with text messages. Friends were wondering if she was okay. Her southeast Portland neighborhood was quiet, so on Tuesday, she drove around the city.
Are we here protesting today?
In the evening, close to 7 p.m., she ended up in front of the ICE building, where NPR talked to her.
I work with a bunch of people around the country, and they were thinking that Portland has this crazy fires and stuff going on. So I was like, I'm going to take some video because it's not happening.
There were probably 24 people outside the immigration building. Some were holding signs urging people to honk if they wanted to abolish ICE. There was a lot of honking, but not a lot else. Some Oregon Republicans, including U.S. Secretary of Labor Lori Chavez DeRemer, praised Trump's decision. The former Oregon congresswoman had urged the president to intervene in the city weeks ago.
I hope you will come to Portland, Oregon, and crack down.
The Oregon Department of Justice filed a temporary restraining order asking a federal judge to block the deployment. A hearing on that order has been scheduled for Friday. For NPR, I'm Lauren Dake in Portland.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Trump administration has followed up on its recent takeover of policing in Washington, D.C. with similar efforts in other Democratic-run cities. Federal agents have ramped up arrests in Memphis. National Guard troops are arriving there, and they are also expected in Portland, Oregon soon. But there is a practical question to all of this. Can this kind of intervention really deter crime? Well, NPR law enforcement correspondent Martin Costi has been talking to criminologists about the federal government's efforts and joins us now. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, let's focus on the use of the National Guard first. They are not police. They do not have arrest powers. I mean, has anyone ever studied whether the National Guard is a good crime deterrent?
Well, so criminologists I've talked to say there are some parallels with other situations. For instance, in the UK, they have these they're called police community support officers, mm-hmm. and they're a bit similar to the guard in that they wear uniforms, they're government employees, but they don't have normal police arrest powers. They're sort of meant to be there to answer people's questions and to be seen. And there was a really well-respected randomized study there about 10 years ago that showed that their presence in crime hotspots did deter crime.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well then, does it look like the U.S. government is trying to use the Guard in the same way that the U.K. uses these community support officers?
So that's not as clear, because the U.K., you know, puts these non-police police in these crime hotspots, which is a criminology term based on real research. Brandon Treagle is a criminologist who's done a lot of work in this. He's at the University of South Carolina.
We know that violent crime's concentrated both in place and in people. So about 10% of offenders account for about 50% of violent crime. About 10% of the most active places account for about 50% of violent crime in a city.
So you can really leverage those stats to get people on the right spot in the right time and really maximize their impact on right. crime. What we don't know, though, is whether the government's doing that with the Guard. We asked the administration, the Department of Defense, and they wouldn't say.
Well, I want to ask you about something that President Trump said during his speech to those generals and admirals on Tuesday. He said, quote, "We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military." Tell me, what do these crime experts think of that suggestion?
Well, no one's absolutely sure what he meant or how serious that was. There's certainly very little support for anything like that in Oregon. President Trump federalized about 200 of the state's own guard to protect federal buildings in Portland. And earlier this week, state legislators asked Russell Gibson, he's with the Oregon Military Department, if he knew about any plan to train troops in American cities. And this is how he responded.
Not that I'm aware of. And I would hate to speculate on what that looks like, but I can't picture in my mind what that would look like at all.
I should add here that Gibson said that the Oregon Guard troops being sent to Portland have had training for crowd control, and a lot of them are actually police officers in their day jobs.
But as we discussed, federal law says that when these people are acting as guard troops in Portland, they do not have normal police power. So I guess that returns us to the original question. How effectively can the National Guard deter crime?
There's no doubt homicides dropped in Washington in August and September when the Guard were there with all those extra federal agents working. But crime policy experts say they'd kind of expect that anywhere if you suddenly beefed up law enforcement. One expert told me what he really wants to see is whether this is sustainable. And he's also watching to see if the sight of the military somehow backfires and causes fear or resentment, which could undermine community relations with local police long term.
That is NPR's Martin Costi. Thank you, Martin.
You're welcome, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. KAXE started without federal funding in 1976. And today, nearly 50 years later, we find ourselves in the same place again. It's a powerful reminder that this station has always been people-powered, and today, that need is even greater. Join us at KAXE.org. The 9th Annual Monarch Butterfly Festival is Saturday, October 4th from 1 to 4 at the new Bemidji Veterans Home on Ann Street. There will be speakers, music, and a children's butterfly parade. Kids should arrive before 3 o'clock to create butterfly wings for the parade. We receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. The 18th Annual Great Pumpkin Festival is Saturday, October 4th from 1 to 4 at Memorial Park in Brainerd. Enjoy games, crafts, and food. The Iron Range Pasty Festival is Saturday, October 4th at Mountain Iron Community Center from 4 to 7. Enjoy pasties made from all local ingredients, plus live music and local farmers market vendors. And the Bemidji Symphony Orchestra presents their premiere of Sky Tinted Water Saturday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at Bemidji High School Auditorium. The song celebrates the 50th anniversary of Voyageurs National Park. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on People Power Radio, KAXE, KBXE.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The federal government is currently shut down because of a fight over health policy. To be specific, it's a fight over the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, otherwise known as Obamacare or healthcare.gov. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin explains what's at stake.
These marketplaces are where people shop when they don't get health insurance through their job or a public program like Medicare or Medicaid. This year, enrollment hit a record 24 million, which, when you think about it, is still only about 7% of the U.S. population. But it is an influential group, says Cynthia Cox of the nonpartisan health research organization, KFF.
It's small business owners, farmers and ranchers.
The fight right now is over whether the federal government should keep spending money to keep the premiums people pay for these plans affordable. A 2021 law created enhanced premium tax credits. Those run out at the end of December unless Congress acts. Cox and her team just did an analysis of what will happen to people's premiums next year.
On average, we're expecting premium payments by enrollees to increase by 114% if these enhanced tax credits expire.
So that means a lot of people are going to have to pay double the monthly premium they're paying now.
Or they might switch to a plan with a much higher deductible, or they might lose their coverage or have to make some other change, for example, getting a different job that does offer health insurance.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 4 million people will become uninsured if the enhanced tax credits expire. It also estimates that extending the policy will cost the government a lot, $350 billion over 10 years. Some Republican lawmakers say that's just too expensive. Other Republicans say they're open to extending the policy, but not as part of the shutdown fight. Here's Vice President J.D. Vance on Fox News Wednesday.
That premium support program doesn't even expire until next year. So why are you shutting down the government on October the 1st because of a program that doesn't even expire for another few months?
Senator Patty Murray says actually it is an urgent issue. She's a Democrat from Washington State and explained in a press conference Wednesday that open enrollment starts November 1st.
Later is too late. The new higher health care rates, those are being set right now. Notifications to families, they're in the mail now. Open enrollment is weeks away and families are panicking.
For Cox, having this relatively small slice of the health insurance pie dominating the political universe gives her deja vu to the repeal and replace fight of 2017 and countless standoffs since then.
Obamacare has always been the center of the political firestorm, at least in health policy. So here we are again.
Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
This Will Smith video tore through the internet recently. So dry your eyes and then you'll find a way. Not for his performance, but for the crowd. Eagle-eyed viewers noticed odd fingers and faces among the fans and suspected AI manipulation. Crowd scenes, like at concerts, rallies, and protests, have long tripped up AI systems, but buckle up because the tech is getting better. NPR's Chloe Veltman has more.
Will Smith's team hasn't publicly commented on how the video was made, but San Francisco-based visual artist and researcher Kit Janay, an expert on AI image creation, says AI was used in places. She dropped by recently to point out where.
That woman's real, that reaction's real, that's not real.
Janay pauses the video when she comes across glitches in the audience footage.
We've got these very long fingers sort of melting into this woman's face. And then it seems like there's maybe her neck is meshing into somebody's hair.
Janae says these weird effects are happening because crowd scenes present a particular technological challenge for AI image creation tools.
You're managing so many intricate details. You have each individual human being in the crowd.
They're all moving independently and have unique features. But Janae says AI models such as Google's Veo 3 and OpenAI Sora 2 are getting pretty good.
We're moving into a world where, in a generous time estimate of a year, the lines of reality are going to get really blurry. And verifying what is real and what isn't real is going to almost have to become like a practice.
And Janae's observation could potentially have serious consequences in a society where images of big, engaged crowds at public events like rock concerts, protests, and political rallies have major currency. Thomas Smith is the CEO of Gaddo Images. The company uses AI to help manage visual archives.
We want a visual metric, a way to determine whether somebody is succeeding or not. And crowd size is often a good indicator of that.
A report from consulting firm Capgemini shows nearly three quarters of images shared on social media in 2023 were generated using AI. With the technology becoming increasingly adept at creating convincing crowd scenes, manipulating visuals has never been easier. With this, Smith says, comes both a creative opportunity and a societal hazard.
AI is a good way to cheat and kind of inflate the size of your crowd.
He adds there's also a flip side to this phenomenon.
If there's a real image that surfaces and it shows something that's politically inconvenient or damaging, there's also going to be a tendency to say, no, that's an AI fake.
Like in August 2024, when then Republican Party nominee Donald Trump spread false claims that Democratic rival Kamala Harris's team used AI to create an image of a big crowd of supporters. Chapman University Emerging Technologies lecturer Charlie Fink says it's especially easy to dupe people into believing a fake crowd scene is real or a real crowd scene is fake because of the mode of delivery.
The challenge is that most people are watching content on a small screen, and most people are not terribly critical of what they see and hear. If it looks real, it is real.
The more realistic and believable we can create the results, the more options it gives people for creative expression.
Oliver Wong is a principal scientist at Google DeepMind. He co-leads the company's image generation efforts. Wong says a balance needs to be struck between enabling users to create ever more realistic and believable content, including detailed crowd scenes, and mitigating potential harms.
Misinformation is something that we do take very seriously. So we are stamping all the images that we generate with a visible watermark.
However, this watermark is tiny and easy to miss, and AI labeling systems, including invisible watermarks, which Google also uses, are still being applied rather unevenly across platforms. There are still no industry-wide standards. Meanwhile, Will Smith has been having more fun with AI since that controversial concert video came out. He posted a playful follow-up. The camera pans from footage of the singer performing energetically on stage to an audience packed with fist-pumping cats. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQIL, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQIL.com. From Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Weather tonight, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, cloudy with temps near 58 degrees. Tomorrow, fog early and partly cloudy with highs 82 to 85 degrees, evening lows in the mid to upper 60s.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.